officials, who are conveniently speaking on the condition of anonymity, go on to say that Iran resourced and encouraged the attack, but that the drones were not launched from Iran. Now, fielding questions from reporters about the attack, Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby said, quote, "I'm not in a position to get into attribution. I'm not going to talk specifics on the attack." Okay, so was it or was it not Iran? In direct contradiction with these anonymous U.S. officials, the Pentagon spokesperson, John Kirby, cannot even tell what munitions were used, let alone Iranian ones. He won't confirm if it's a Shia militia group, which again doesn't necessarily mean Iran, but he also does not confirm whether it's a state-sponsored attack.
Can we assume it was a Shia militia group, or is that not
what I said? We've seen these kinds of attacks before. I'm not going to get into specific attribution on this one.
The number of rockets, do we have any more specifics on that? We were told two drones and a number of rockets. Are there any specifics?
I don't have an update for you on the munitions that were used. We believe it was a complex, coordinated, and deliberate attack.
And is it possible that this was a state-sponsored attack?
Again, I'm not going to go any further on attribution at this point. We're still working our way through.
So the Americans have said that they were warned in advance, they were tipped off about the attack, and they've also blamed Iran for it. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think they're just using this as a card to hold against Iran? Because if we're being realistic, you know, when you invade other countries, Syria in this case, you're going to anger a lot of people. So it could have been Syrians, Iraqis. I mean, why are they doing that? Why are they saying that? And is there some truth to it?
Well, just saying the word Iran is a buzzword that is used in the Western propaganda, and anybody and everybody that's resisting American hegemony and its vessels, the Saudis, the Israelis in the region here in Western Asia, is called an Iranian tool, and Iran is blamed for it. So, unfortunately for the American public, this doesn't portray the truth, which is that there is an alliance of sovereign states and actors like Hezbollah, like the Syrian government, like the Yemeni resistance, that are choosing to align themselves together because they have a strategic goal of forcing the United States and its vessels out of the region. So the truth is, until now, we don't have a clear indication, a written statement, an announcement by who actually committed this resistance attack on Al-Tanf base, but it doesn't matter really, because we know that the Syrian government itself said that it's going from this point on to be responding to any Israeli attacks. So that gives you an indication.
The same day that Al-Tanf was hit, 14 Syrian military personnel were killed in a terrorist attack in central Damascus. How does that tie in to the events at Al-Tanf?
So it's clear that there is some schism within the imperial coalition. So we know this schism started way back with Obama and his plan to bring the Muslim Brotherhood into power in the Arabic world, led by Turkey and Qatar. And that led to a revolt by the Saudis and the Israelis, and who brought Trump into power. Okay, so that's a schism between the Wahhabi and the Ikhwani, or conservative and liberal sides of imperialism, if you want to say so. And we know that right now, Egypt and Jordan, in alliance with the liberal wings of the empire, were trying to bring in electricity and gas to Lebanon through Syria. And part of this, Biden being part of the liberal side of the empire, had facilitated this. And so we saw the withdrawal of all the Wahhabi Contras from the south of Syria, and the expansion of the Syrian military presence all the way to the Golan Heights borders of the occupied part. And so this three different IUDs that were placed, two of them exploded, one of them didn't, is probably a message from the Saudis and the Israelis, the conservative part of the empire, that are rebelling against the possibility of opening relations between Jordan, Egypt, and Syria and Lebanon, and the lifting of the Lebanese economic crisis.
About a week after the attack on Al-Tanf, Israel again bombed Syria, not by air like it usually does, but using surface-to-surface missiles. Laith, why do you think the Zionists took a different approach to Syria this time and did not use their planes?
The Israelis fired surface-to-surface missiles on the outskirts of Damascus and Qudsiyah suburb. Right. And this tells you another thing. You see, over the last 2 days, the Israeli Air Force kept on attempting to reach even the Golan Heights, and the Syrian radars and air defenses were painting them red before they even reached the Golan Heights. So what does this mean? That meant that that was a message to the Israeli Air Force that they will be shot down over Palestine before they even reach the Golan Heights, let alone Syrian airspace. They will be fired upon and shot down. And this is very significant to see today, for the first time in 10 years, that the Israelis use surface-to-surface missiles to hit Damascus, which means that their air force now is out of commission in the game of attacking Syria.
Now, the Israelis have admitted to doing hundreds of airstrikes on Syria, and although Israel doesn't usually comment on its illegal activities, the mainstream media, who serve as a mouthpiece for them, are more than happy to push this narrative that Israel is bombing Hezbollah and Iranian targets inside Syria, as if that somehow makes it okay or justifies an act of war and aggression. The United States attempts to justify its illegal bases, claiming that it's in Syria to fight Daesh. I mean, who invited you? Because the last time I checked, the United States has no permission to be in Syria, so whether its troops are making pancakes or fighting Daesh is irrelevant. Number two, the United States helped to create Daesh directly, if not indirectly, just like it did with Al-Qaeda. And third, Daesh was defeated by the PMU, by Iran, Hezbollah, and the Syrian and Russian armed forces. The United States played a minimal role, if any, in defeating Daesh. As a matter of fact, the United States has killed Syrian soldiers on multiple occasions, the same Syrian soldiers who were fighting terrorists. Who benefits from that except Daesh? Israel bombs Syria almost on a weekly basis, acting as a de facto air force for Daesh. Now earlier, John Kirby, the Pentagon spokesperson, said that the United States has the right to defend itself.
I think you've heard us say before that the right of self-defense.
So let me get this straight. The United States has the right to defend itself in Syria? How can you invade another country and then talk about self-defense? This is incredible. When you invade other people's countries and illegally occupy them, you're going to anger a lot of people. So this act of resistance in Al-Tanf could have been Syrians, Iraqis, who knows? I mean, given the sophistication of the attack and the timing, that narrows it down, of course, but if you want to talk about Iran, I mean, Iran certainly supports resistance movements in the region, and proudly, but this report, I mean, conveniently issued by anonymous U.S. officials, sounds a lot like just randomly assigning blame to Iran without any proof. Regardless, though, it's insane how the United States invades other people's countries, occupies them, steals their resources, and then starts playing the victim. In what dimension does that make any sense except in the imperialist Western mindset? Nevertheless, let one thing be clear. The illegal occupation of Syria, of the Levant, of West Asia, is not going to last forever. This has become a very, very costly war for Western colonizers. And the balance of power in the region is starting to shift. Sooner or later, like all other empires who thought that they would last forever and they could hold on to the Middle East, the United States and Israel will have to retreat. It's simply a question of when. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Amma ba'd faqad qala Allahul Hakim fi kitabihi al-mubin bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Afa hasibtum annama khalaqnakum abathan wa annakum ilayna la turja'un? The topic which, as we had announced or has been announced to the community, that we want to look at is, what does Allah expect from us? How do we live a God-centric life? What does Allah want from you and I as believers? You know, the verse that I began with, which will form the basis of our talk tonight, comes to us from chapter number 23, Surah Al-Mu'minun, verse 115, in which Allah poses what we call a rhetorical question. He poses a question to us. He knows the answer. You and I know the answer. But sometimes we forget the answer, or we try and cover it up because of our own wants of the dunya. And Allah says, "Afahasibtum?" Do you, humanity, think? Do you presume? Do you suppose? أَنَّمَا خَلَقَنَاكُمْ عَبَثًا, that we created you, the human being, abath, for no purpose, for no goal, just to play around, just to watch or play video games, just to have entertainment, abath, to watch your Netflix series and binge on what you watch on the streaming services, and play sports, and be caught up in the rat race of life? أَفَحَسِبْتُمْ أَنَّمَا خَلَقْنَاكُمْ عَبَثًا وَأَنَّكُمْ إِلَيْنَا لَا تُرْجَعُونَ, and that you would never come back to us, that you would never die, you would never leave this world, that you would never come back to the day of accountability in front of Allah? Obviously, the answer to this is the opposite of the verse. So if Allah says, don't you think that this would happen? The response is yes. This will happen. This is a reality of life. We were not created abathan. We were not created without a purpose. We have a purpose on life, my brothers and sisters. And we will go back to Allah, and we will be held accountable for our actions. And so when I say, and I want to move into this next phase, how do we lead that God-centric life? How do we lead a life where we work, we go to school, we make money, we live a life? How do we do so, but live a God-centric life? So I want to ask three questions and hopefully answer these three in the next 10 minutes or so. One is that, what is a God-centric life? Again, that's the topic for tonight. How do we lead a God-centric life? But what is a God-centric life? Number two, how do we live a God-centric life? How do we make Allah, God, our focal, our pivot, that everything we do in life revolves around Him? And number three is that, what would be the outcome if we had a truly God-centric life? What would we expect to gain? Because maybe you'll say, well, what difference does it make? I could be like my friends, co-workers, or they don't follow Islam, they don't follow Allah, they don't pray, they don't fast, they don't go for Hajj, they don't give khums, zakah, sadaqah, they don't go for ziyarah, they don't come to the majlis of Muharram. Why does that make me any different than them? Why can't I live the same life that they lead? So let me answer the first question of, what is a God-centric life? What I would say is that living a God-centric life means that we have to have a paradigm shift. A paradigm shift meaning a change in the way that we look at ourselves and our relationship to Allah, to our Creator, within the context, obviously, of the religion of Islam. Having this paradigm shift literally means that we have to reanalyze where Allah is in our lives. If Allah is at the periphery of our lives, He's just at the boundary. And you know, whenever we have a problem, we go to Allah. Whenever we have a difficulty, we go to Allah, as unfortunately many brothers and sisters in our community do. They don't come to the Husayniyat. They don't come to the Masajid. Maybe in Muharram they come. Maybe on the Layali al-Qadr, in the nights of Qadr and Ramadan, they'll come. They'll spend maybe half an hour, an hour. But they don't come on Thursday night. They won't make it a point to come to the Salatul Jum'ah. They won't come on the birth anniversaries of the 14 infallibles. They worship Allah on the periphery. But then when the problem comes in their life, they're having marital disputes. The wife is not treating the husband well. The husband is not treating the wife well. Then they come to the sheikh, they come to the alim, they come to the scholar of the community. They come to the Husayniyah, they come to the masjid, they come back to Allah. Now I don't say don't come back to Allah, but Allah should be at the forefront, at the middle of our lives, not at the edges, only when we have problems. As Allah says, there are some people who worship Allah al-harf, right, at the borders of the fringes of life. We don't want to be like that, where Allah is there at the end when there's problems, when nothing else can solve the problems, then I'll go to Allah. No, Allah should be at the focal point of our lives. Centered, our life should be centered around Allah. It should gravitate around Allah, around the Quran, around the religion, around the Prophet, around the Ahlul Bayt, alayhum as-salatu was-salam. This is what I say, when we have a God-centric life, it comes that paradigm shift, that Islam is no longer at the periphery of when I have a problem, but rather Islam is there at times of good and times of bad. When times are easy, when times are difficult. Times of happiness, times of sorrow. Allah is the focal point every time. Rather than saying that I'll worship Allah when I have free time, I'll worship Allah when I have vacation time, I'll worship Allah when difficulties come into my life. No, I begin to worship Allah all the time. I follow what Allah wants all the time. Not when I want something, not when I need something, but even if I don't want anything. And who can deny that we are always in need of Allah? Allah tells us in the Quran that antumul fuqara. You, O humanity, are fuqara. You are in utter need every moment of your life. And Allah is ghani. He's selfless. He doesn't need anybody. He doesn't need you and I to become God. He doesn't become bigger for us to, you know, for us, by us worshiping Him. Rather, He doesn't become a bigger God. So how do we lead that God-centric life? If I'm saying that we have to change our paradigm or have a paradigm shift, how do we get to that level? Well, there's no easy formula. There's no magic pill. I can give you the red pill or the blue pill and you take your pick. And if you choose the right one, then you get to the level of having Allah in the focal point of your life. I can't give that to you. But the Quran can give it to us. The Prophet of Islam can give it to us. The Ahlul Bayt, the true representatives of the Messenger of Allah, may God's peace and blessings be upon them, they can give that solution to us. Let me take you through three stages of how to begin to develop this God-centricity, this making Allah the focal point of our lives. Now just let me say before I go on to that, that I don't say that you forget everything else, that you forget your parents, you forget your spouse, you ignore your children, you don't go to work, you don't go to school. No, all of those are a part of this. But they are done after understanding the role of Allah, that He is the true, you know, He's the true Allah, He's the true sustainer. And all of these things, our parents, our family, our children, our job, our education, they are all required. They all have to be there.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen. شكور ودود قيوم محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. We have an interesting story for today. A young man was proud of his healthy and beautiful heart. One day, standing in the middle of the town, he proclaimed that he had the most beautiful heart in the whole valley. A large crowd gathered to have a look at his heart. His heart was smooth, shiny, and looked very healthy. Indeed, the man had the most beautiful heart in the valley, everyone agreed. The proud young man felt delighted and boasted his perfect heart, which everyone admired. Suddenly, a voice from the crowd said, "Your heart is not as beautiful as mine." The young man searched for the person, and an old man appeared in front of him. "Show us your heart if you believe you have got more beautiful heart than mine," said the young man. The old man carefully showed his heart. The crowd and the young man looked at the old man's heart. The heart was beating strongly and healthily, but it was not smooth and shiny as the young man's heart. Instead, it had scars all over it. It had places where some pieces of the heart had been removed and other pieces were put in. The other pieces didn't fit perfectly, and there were several uneven edges. In some places, there were deep gouges where some pieces were missing. The crowd laughed at the old man's heart. How can he claim that he has the most beautiful heart when it is all scarred and uneven? They thought. The young man looked at the old man's heart and laughed. "You must be kidding. Compare your heart and mine. My heart looks perfect and smooth, and yours is a mess of scars and tears." "Yes, your heart looks perfect, but I would never trade your heart with mine," said the old man. "Every scar in my heart represents a person whom I had given my love. I tear a piece of my heart and give to them. Often my loved one gives me back a piece of their heart which fits into the empty place in my heart. Since everyone loves each other in a different way, their piece of heart may not perfectly fit my heart, so you can see some rough edges. These scars and rough edges remind me of the love we shared," he continued. Sometimes I would give a piece of my heart, but the other person may not return a piece of his heart to me. These are the empty gouges. Although these gouges are painful, these remind me of the love I have for these people too. So do you now see what a true beauty? Asked the old man. The young man and crowd stood silently, with tears running down their cheeks. The young man walked to the old man, reached into his perfect young and beautiful heart, ripped a piece out of it, and offered it to the man with trembling hands. The old man gratefully received, placed it in his heart, and then took a piece from his old heart and placed it in the young man's heart. The young man looked at his heart. It did not look shiny and smooth like it used to, but it was now more beautiful because he could feel the love from the old man's heart flowing into him. Sayyid Hussein al-Ghazwini.
Like anything that is not put under control, love can have its dangers. Love can be dangerous. Love can have dangerous side effects if we don't deal with it logically and rationally. If we deal with it emotionally, it could have very dangerous side effects. For example, love can make us blind. They say love is blind. Love makes us blind. How? You can't see the real face of the person that you love. You only see the good in the person that you love. You overlook the vices, the bad. You overlook, you give a blind eye. Either you don't see the bad in the person that you love, especially in the beginning, when you first meet someone and you fall in love and you want to get married and you develop a relationship. You either don't see the vices, you don't see the bad, or you give a blind eye. You only see the good and you exaggerate the good. In your mind, you exaggerate the good. This is very dangerous. This is very dangerous. One day you wake up. One day after several months, after a couple of years, when the romance fades away, when there's no more sweet talking, when there's no more romantic dinners, when there's real problems and obstacles in the relationship, you wake up and you realize the vices in this person, the bad side of this person, the side that you hadn't seen, or the side that you chose not to see. You know, I see a lot of couples, after a year or 2 years of marriage, they say, we want to get divorced. Why? They say, because this person changed. This person changed. No, my dear friend, this person never changed. This person was always the way that he is now or she is now, but you didn't see it. You didn't see it. This person was always like this. But you chose not to see this side because you were in love. You gave a blind eye to the bad sides, to the vices of this person. People in your community tried to tell you. Your mother tried to tell you. Your father tried to tell you. Your best friends tried to tell you. But you gave a deaf ear and a blind eye because you only saw one picture. And that's the picture that you wanted to see. You didn't want to see anything else. This person didn't change. This person was the same person that he was or she was a year ago. I hear from a lot of couples, this person changed. No, the person never changed. The person never changed. But you woke up. You opened your eyes. Now you see things that you weren't able to see before. Why? Because of love. Because you were blinded by love. Blind love, my dear friends, blind love sometimes makes us illogical. It makes us irrational. We do things that are irrational, illogical. You see, some teens or young people, they decide to run away. And they go and they get married by themselves without the blessings of their parents. Because their parents rejected, they stood in the face of their marriage. So they run away, they get hitched. They go and they get married somewhere else, they run away. This is illogical, this is irrational. This blind love, it got them to do things that are irrational. Illogical, they can't think rationally and logically. There are some, because of this blind love, they're willing to ruin their own families. You see this husband, He has everything going for him. He has a beautiful wife, a loving, caring wife that takes care of him and his children. He has beautiful children. He has an excellent job. He has a lovely house. Everything's working fine. But he meets a young lady, and he thinks that he's in love. And she has taken over his mind. He's willing to sacrifice his entire family because of this young lady. This is illogical. This is irrational. To sacrifice something so beautiful that you've built for so many years, it goes all to waste. You put it all to waste for someone new, for a stranger that you don't know. And you don't know whom she's spoken to or him. You sacrifice your life for an individual, for a man that you barely even know, who's a complete stranger. A relationship like that, my dear friends, will never work. A relationship that starts like this, that you had to give up everything, you had to sacrifice your family for, this sort of relationship never works out. And never works out, unless there's a miracle. You see, my dear friends, love can make us selfless. A wife that loves her husband, she's willing to get up early in the morning to make him breakfast. She makes breakfast for herself. She goes to work. She comes back early just to cook him food, dinner. She's selfless. And he's selfless as well. Love makes us selfless. We give all that we have for those that we love. But it could also make us selfish. Blind love can also make us selfish. You know, you say, I don't care if this man is married. I don't care if he has a wife and he has children. I'm in love with him. I deserve to be with him. I should be his wife, not her. And you steal a man. Or the opposite. A man comes and steals a wife from a family and he gets her to perform a divorce so that he can marry. This is selfishness. This is selfishness. He thinks that he's in love. This is blind love that causes him to be selfish. Love can make us selfless, but it could also at the same time make us selfish. Blind love, one of the side effects and dangers is that it takes over our minds. All you want to talk about is the person that you're in love with. I'm sure you've seen with your friends, with siblings, family members, when they're in love with someone, all they can talk about is this person that they're in love with. And any topic, raise any topic, it could be food, they'll relate that person to food, or they'll relate food to that person. All they could talk about is this person that they're in love with, because it's taken over their mind. Right? And they relate anything, any sort of topic, to that person. Their life revolves around that person.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi aman Allah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
Welcome back. We met Javad Qarai, an enthusiastic young nature explorer, and followed him as he discovered some of Iran's most unspoiled natural attractions in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. We visited the exotic Martian mountains with their peculiar shapes and ventured deep into the intertwining and spiral cave of the region. And finally, we joined Javad as he gazed into the mesmerizing waters of the Sea of Oman above the rocky cliffs. Stay with us as we further explore the wonders of the region and meet the kind-hearted locals.
The area is so beautiful and unspoiled. It is home to large flocks of birds,
such as the cormorants sitting on the sandy beaches offering a scenic spectacle. It is the perfect place for bird watchers to come and feast their eyes on these exotic animals. Bird watching is a branch of tourism, or to be exact, ecotourism. Bird watchers are steadily growing in number. Cormorants are aquatic birds. They are medium to large in size, with a body weight in the range of 0.35 to 5 kilograms and a wingspan of 45 to 100 centimeters. The majority of the species have dark feathers. They are excellent divers, and underwater, they propel themselves with their feet with help from their wings. Some cormorant species have been found to dive as deep as 45 meters. Cormorants nest in colonies around the shore, on trees, islets, or cliffs. They are coastal rather than oceanic birds, and some have colonized inland waters. Indeed, the original ancestor of cormorants seems to have been a freshwater bird. In my previous trips here, I saw large flocks of these beautiful birds here in this season, but this time there aren't so many of them. One of the reasons behind the decline in their populations is because some of the locals hunt and eat them. Although cormorants are not supposed to be eaten because they are carnivorous. According to some religious scholars, flesh-eating birds are not to be eaten. The flesh of carnivorous birds may contain many diseases that can be passed on to humans if eaten, but the locals are not aware of that. Those who hunt the cormorants do not do so because there is nothing else to eat, so they have no reason to kill and consume so many of these poor birds and do irreparable damage to the wildlife and environment in the region. The environment and wildlife are manifestations of God's beauty. How can humans, who consider themselves the greatest of creations, allow themselves to harm the manifestations of God's beauty? Human survival on the planet Earth inevitably depends on the environment and on the wildlife. Therefore, our country's officials should educate the local populations and make sure that the environment in each and every part of the country is well taken care of. This has been a very beautiful day for me. Berries is one of the most beautiful places I have visited, and I have visited many over the years. A day later, I'm on my way to a beautiful village in the heart of nature, accompanied by my good friend, Sheer Muhammad Rahul. To get to Sham-e-Kohne, that's the name of the village, we have to walk a relatively long way surrounded by beautiful natural beauties. Near the village, we run into a shepherd named Sheer Muhammad, sitting under an old leafless tree by a pond. His is the simplest of lifestyles. The Baluch mainly speak the Baluchi language, a branch of northwestern Iranian languages. Experts say the Baluch language is very similar to that of the Medes, a people of Indo-Iranian origin, who inhabited the western and northwestern portion of present-day Iran. And that is a testimony to the deep roots of the Baluch tribe in Iran. Today, the Baluch people live in the southwest of Iran, the south of Pakistan, Afghanistan, Oman, India, the UAE, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Zanzibar. Borders between countries haven't been able to separate members of this ancient Iranian tribe. Although they live in different countries, the Baluch have preserved their traditions. They pay each other visits, and intertribal marriages are common. The Shahnameh and several other old books have placed the dwelling place of the Baluch people
and around the north of modern-day Khorasan province. For various reasons, this peace-loving, serene tribe have had to move here, the southeast of Iran, and lived in peace since. Shir Muhammad Baluch is one of the original members of the old Sham village. But today, the village is nothing more than a collection of abandoned buildings where he can rest during sizzling hot days. This is amazing. They place one lantern and both families lived under the light of that one lantern. There isn't much left of the old Sham village, but even the ruins of it speak of the very rich culture of the kind, hospitable Baluch people. One of the structures that has stood the test of time is the beautiful mosque of Old Sham, built by the very hands of those who inhabited the village many years ago. It's gotten unbearably hot by now. I am kilometers away from the coast of the Sea of Oman in Baluchistan. But that distance is not going to keep me from a much-needed dive on the golden sand beach. The difference between the temperatures in Iran's climate zones is incredible, and to many, unbelievable. I'm in the southeasternmost part of Iran, swimming in the Sea of Oman in the middle of winter. On this same day, some of my mountaineer friends climbing up Mount Damavand tell me the temperature where they are is around minus 30 degrees. That's a difference of 60 degrees between two areas of Iran. I've done my swimming, and now I've decided to travel to the southeastern end of Iranian territory. That's the Gwadar Bay, located in the Gulf of Oman on the maritime border of Iran and Pakistan. A lot of fish is caught and brought to shore here. Many large trawler launches unload their catches on smaller boats on the shore. Before they arrive in Iranian territory, the fish coming from those launches are purchased by middlemen and transported to big cities around the country. The main purpose of my trip to Gwadar Bay is to see the beautiful Hara mangrove forest in this border area. Hara is a species of the Lantana genus. The seeds from the tree fall into the water, where wave action takes them to more stationary parts of the sea. The Hara seeds become fixed in the soil layers of the sea and grow. Hara trees are saltwater plants that are often submerged at high tide. They are salt-tolerant trees and are adapted to life in harsh coastal conditions. They contain a complex salt filtration system and a complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. They are adapted to the low oxygen conditions of waterlogged mud. We are now exactly at the mouth of Hurebahu. This is the zero point that separates Iran from Pakistan. We are about to enter a very beautiful river. As a matter of fact, it's a Hur or Firth. It's not a river. And it continues a long way in that direction. Hurebahu is in fact a bay area created by water from the Sea of Oman. This is the last spot before you actually arrive in the sea itself. Before the Firth, there is the Bahu Kalat River that flows from Sarbaz Mountains to the Gulf of Oman. This is it. I can see the mountains of Pakistan vividly from here. Pakistan is located right on the other side of the Hara Forest. A lot of birds and fish live here in this Firth, which, as I said, was created by salty waters from the Sea of Oman. It's a very beautiful area. The Hara Forests spanning this area are indeed unique. The Hara tree grows to heights of 6 meters and has bright green leaves and twigs. It is a species of the mangrove tree that can grow in coastal saline or brackish water. They have a complex salt filtration system and complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. The Hara excludes salt by having significantly impermeable roots, which are highly impregnated with suberin, acting as an ultrafiltration mechanism to exclude sodium salts from the rest of the plant. Hara trees grow in 8 protected areas in Iran and are fortunately looked after by both the authorities and people. The Hara forests in the south of Iran are a major habitat for migratory birds in the cold season, and for reptiles, fish, and varieties of bivalves. Green or hooked turtles and venomous aquatic snakes are also indigenous to the forests. Bird life includes herons, flamingos, pelicans, and angler eagles. Another important feature of these forests is the appropriate and suitable seabed conditions for the ovulation of fish in the Persian Gulf. The locals say you are very likely to run into a school of dolphins passing Gwadar Bay on your way to see the Hara forests. But looks like I'm down on my luck today. There are still many villages in Baluchistan that have weathered the storm of time and preserved their traditional look. But the way to visit one of them is to seek guidance from a local guide. And that person is none other than my very own friend, Shir Muhammad. We have a long way ahead of us to the village we have decided to visit. To get there, we have to drive on a vast plain. There are no paved roads. Not so much as a dirt track. The name of the village is Nilay. Baluchistan is a very dry province. It rains very little here. As a result, not very long ago, the people of Baluchistan would dig a catchment to accumulate what little rainwater that fell from the sky. Those catchments acted as their only water reservoirs. They called them hutags. The importance of drinking water is not lost on anyone nowadays. Aware of the shortage of this vital liquid, countries around the world have embarked on preserving and conserving drinking water in recent years. The best way to prevent water from going to waste in a country like Iran that's facing a severe water problem is changing the consumption pattern. Put it simply, every human being needs only 10 liters of water to wash their whole body. But most of us keep the water running while having a shower and let something between 100 and 200 liters of precious drinking water go into the septic tank. Nowadays, most of us think that to keep our yards clean, we have to wash them with tap water every week. While in the past, although the problem of water was not as serious in Iran as it is now, and the population was not as big, people would clean their yards with sprinkles of water and a broom. And the purpose was to prevent dust from rising when sweeping. In the past, there weren't as many cars that needed to be washed with drinking water every few days. But today, millions of liters of water is consumed every year to wash the millions of vehicles across the country. I came to realize the importance of drinking water in recent years. On one of my trips to this same Baluchistan region, I ended up bathing with only 3 liters of water after going without a wash for a whole week. It was a time when the people here were grappling with a drought. That incident led me to understand the importance of drinking water in Iran. I now understand why we shouldn't let even a single drop of it go to waste. This is one of the oldest houses in this whole area. In this whole village. And Haji Khodabakhsh was in fact born in this same house. He's giving me a tour of the interior. The houses in the village of Nilag are beautiful and traditional. But there is one house in this village that is very old, very beautiful, and unique. In Baluchi language, this house is called a kud. It is dark in the house. There is no electricity, no running water, and not even a room. This is all there is to it. The owner says that all the members of the family, and there were 9 of them, used to live together in this house that is no more than one big lounge. But despite all the deprivations, the members of the family are as close as ever. The Baluch are a very kind, family-loving people. I feel an eerie feeling of calm among these pure souls. Baluch hospitality makes any stranger visiting these parts feel at home in their houses. You feel like you were born and raised in one of these houses and lived a good, simple life growing up with these genial and warm people. Most of the Baluch people who don't go fishing at sea are herders, and in this area, camels are the best livestock to keep. Camels have adapted very well to the environment and climate of Baluchistan. My journey is coming to an end. Sheer Muhammad tells me about one of his friends. Mr. Shah Bash is one of the main camel herders in the region. The old camel rider tells me about Baluch kindness towards all of the world's creatures. Kindness embedded in the culture of this people. The Baluch are a very kind and passionate people, traits that are evident in the words of Mr. Shah Bash. When I ask him if he has ever tried camel meat, he says the Baluch normally do not eat camel. That's because camels are loved by these people, and so they don't have the heart to slaughter them, much less eat their meat. I have arrived at the end of my trip, a trip that taught me many valuable lessons about the Baluch people and Baluchistan. This is a province with a beautiful, unspoiled environment, a place where the sea meets the mountains and plains. The Baluch people, with their rich ancient culture, are a source of great pride for Iran. I, too, am proud of these honest, kind people. Proud of having such generous fellow countrymen and women. The Sea of Oman looks like a drop of water against the unfathomable hearts of these people. All I want for the people here is proper, stable jobs compatible with their culture and environment, created by competent and caring government officials. I hope for facilities and development to come to this part of my country without doing any damage to its ancient culture and pristine environment.
Perhaps Iran's internationally renowned mosques and ancient remnants of Isfahan and Shiraz are what attracts most visitors from far and wide, but I'm sure many nature-loving individuals have become interested in visiting Iran's southernmost region and the pristine natural wonders of Sistan and Balochistan. And that's it for this week, everyone. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I'm your host Musa al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss issues, questions, and other relevant circumstances or topics parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers are based upon the Holy Quran and the narrations of the household of the Prophet, and of course of the Prophet himself, peace be upon them all. Joining us in our studio is our guest speaker and dear friend Sayyid Abdullah Musa, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you, and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Our topic today is about the different life phases of the child and how important it is to understand these phases. And to do that, we must understand how a child acts in these phases. The last phase we spoke about was the ages of 3 to 6 years old. We said that a child at this age is very curious. It's also fiercely defiant and rebellious, and also has a very, very sharp mind, which means that they remember many things at that young age. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه. So we were basically saying that as a parent, as an educator, you need to understand that throughout the life of a child, each year he would go through something, each year would change, and understanding the phase itself, it gives a bit of assurance to the parents to know that what's happening is actually normal and fine. So, for example, we say at the age of 4 and 4 plus, kids usually start asking questions about death, right?
Interesting.
So when kids start to ask about death and dying and where people go after they die, a lot of parents get scared and take that as a sign that their kids might be going through an emotional state,
right,
or something could be going wrong with them.
Just let me interrupt you for 1 second here. I'm sorry,